Hello and welcome to Brutally Honest, and thank you for joining me for episode 3. This episode is a powerful one, heartbreaking and also inspirational. It's a story of Madeline Black, author of Unbroken. It goes on to tell us about how she got raped at the age of 13 and then multiple times before she was 18. Madeline is an avid speaker on to help others who suffered the same ordeal, men and women, to help get over and overcome that dark past. She also has her own podcast out, which is called Unbroken, and is certainly one to listen to. Madeline, how are you? Well, first of all, thank you for coming on my podcast today. This is going to be an amazing story you've got to tell, and I can't wait to share it. But again, thank you for coming on and taking the time out.
Oh, thank you, Jermaine, for asking me. And I'm doing good. I'm speaking from a very drizzly grey Glasgow, so it's not a beautiful day, but hey.
Hey, well, it's not too sunny here either, so sorry. But so you've got a bestseller out book called Unbroken, which was released in 2017, if I'm correct.
It was, yes. It's about 5 years old now. Yep.
5 years old, and it tells your, you know, my listeners probably won't know, but your remarkable story. I won't say remarkable, but heartwarming, and the tragedy that you went through. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and obviously your what you've gone through?
Yes, so the book really tells my own personal story of being gang raped at just 13 years old by two men. And it really follows my journey of, I guess, surviving it, healing, forgiveness, transformation and hope.
Yeah, it's to come out the way you have is remarkable. And I've listened to your TED talks. I've read your book as well, and it's honestly, I take my hat off to you. It's what you've been through is horrendous, such a vile crime. But for you to speak openly about it and be so strong and come out a better place is fantastic, and it's a great insight. And also for other people who may have gone through difficulties like yourself, being able to, you know, come out of the darkness in a better light.
Absolutely. You know, I really do believe that it's not really about what happens to us. It's more important what we do with it. And, you know, if we choose to and we get the right support, we can find our voice and speak out, we really can heal and have a great life. People assume that, you know, you would be damaged for the rest of your life and you'd never be okay. But you can actually have an amazing life. You know, you can recover from extreme trauma and live a great life, which is what I intend to do.
Yeah, so it was 13 that you got raped, and how did that come about? What the scenario?
Yeah, I guess really I did with a friend what everybody's done at some point in their life. We lied one night about where we were staying because her mum was away. You know, this is going back a few years ago, so it was the late 1970s. We managed to buy some alcohol in a local corner shop. Didn't really need ID or anything in those days. A bottle of vodka, and I had never drunk before. We went to a little cafe in North London, and we drank it in secret. And yeah, just very quickly, I was just very sick. And there was a group of guys on our table, but two of them put us into a taxi, and they took us back to my friend's mum's flat, which obviously was empty because we weren't meant to be there. And it just became, you know, very obvious really quickly on that they weren't there to help me. They were there to do other things. And the two of them proceeded to, I guess, rape and torture me over about a 4 to 5 hour period.
It's sad to hear. And, you know, I'm sorry to hear about that. And, you know, going through that ordeal, you know, later on in life, how did it affect you? And obviously you've had to have that built up and not really express it. How hard was not telling anyone and keeping it to yourself?
Yeah, I don't think it was a conscious decision. I think it's just what your body does when it goes into shock because of trauma. But one of the very last things one of them said to me is that if I spoke about it, they threatened me with a knife, you know, that they would find me and they'd kill me. And after some of the things, I called him the worst one, after some of the things he had done to me, yeah, I looked in his eyes and I thought this man was capable of killing me. So that shut me up for a start. But the trauma as well, it's not a place you want to go to. So I spent a lot of time pushing it out of my head, kind of depressing it down and avoiding it. But, you know, it's got to come out somehow. So I developed an eating disorder. I became suicidal. I attempted suicide. I was in a children's psychiatric ward for a good few months. I used drugs, alcohol, anything to really numb out, really, and just push it far away. I had fears, phobias, anxieties, nightmares. I rebelled. I became promiscuous. And, you know, there's no set way that a woman or a man will respond after they've been raped, but there's many similarities for a lot of people. They will have similar feelings. And I guess it's really, it's what it did to my head for a long time. I just thought I was contaminated. You know, I was just a disgusting, dirty person because of what had happened. But it took me a long, long time to realize that we're not the things that are done to us. None of us are. We're more than that, really. I'm more than my body and what was done to it.
Yeah, so I understand that trauma because I've been through childhood trauma myself, and it led me to make certain mistakes in my adult life. Yeah. But before the incident happened, 13, how was you as a child? Was you, you know, a nice upbringing? Was you, you know, a good child or not rebellious?
I was quite quiet and quite a shy little girl. I was one of five. I'm in the middle. My mum was bedridden for a while, so she was home and she was ill, and there was always people looking after her. So I guess maybe the night out that my friend suggested was a bit of escapism, you know, do something that I don't normally do. But I was just a very well-behaved, good girl that got on with her schoolwork and, you know, wanted to make her parents happy and proud. But it did change after that. Schoolwork was not really my focus after that.
So I'm thinking, so obviously after that incident, 13 going onwards, there was a big, I would say, a big change in your behavior, your mannerisms, you know, leaders. And did the family or friends or anyone start wondering or questioning what where's Madeleine's gone so wrong?
Yeah, they didn't really. You know, when I wrote my book, someone said to me that I could get my notes from the children's psychiatric ward. And I thought, okay. So I applied. I was in for several months and there were loads of pages that came, but a huge chunk were for having tonsillitis, being in Great Ormond Street. Another chunk was for a kidney infection. Just a small amount of pages was for these several months in this psychiatric ward. But nowhere in the pages did it say she must have been traumatized, something must have happened. They just had me down as adolescent with issues and an eating disorder, a depressed adolescent. But nowhere did they suggest that she'd had any kind of trauma. So I guess you could just look at it and say she's just a troubled teenager, whatever they used to say in those days. But it's really, I think now, come on, it must have been so flipping obvious that something must have gone wrong somewhere.
And at what age did you tell your parents finally? Because I know, I've read your book and I've listened to your TED Talks, and you did try and, you know, come out, but it was difficult. But at what age did you finally, you know, they realize?
It took me about 3 years. When I was about 16, my mum said, don't go out. And I just went out anyway. And I snuck back in really, really late or early one morning. And she is waiting in the hallway for me. And she's just really, really angry and shaking me. And by then, my behavior was a bit off the wall. And she's just saying, you know, you're putting yourself into so much danger. Anything could actually happen to you the way that you're behaving. Inside, you know, I'm trying to scream out the words, but I couldn't. And looking back, I think maybe subconsciously, I thought they would guess that something was wrong by my bad behavior. You know, I couldn't actually spit the words out. So I wrote a little note which kind of outlined, you know, roughly the details. And that night when I came in from school, my mum and dad are waiting, and they called my friend who was there as well, but she didn't give the same story as me. She said, no, they were nice boys. They were both sons of diplomats. And, you know, they just brought us home. They wouldn't do what she said. So it was like, oh my gosh, I've taken 3 years to finally find my voice. And then my story wasn't backed up. And I just felt so betrayed. My dad, he still wanted to go to the police. My mum was really, really quiet, and she gives me permission to share her story because I write about it as well. And it was only many, many years later, after my dad had passed away, that my mum told me that she had also been raped by a neighbour when she was just 8 years old. So in that moment, when I'm sharing it, my dad was wanting to go to police, but my mum was quiet. So I thought she didn't believe me, but actually she'd never told my dad, despite having five kids between them and no therapy or anything for herself. She just got on with it, but she was too scared to say anything because her trauma kind of silenced her. So it's really hard to find your voice. And then especially when you're not backed up or believed, it just impacts on what you're really feeling. So it was a bit of a downward spiral after that for me as well.
Yeah, I can imagine 3 years of not, you know, being able to share your story and get that pain off your chest must have been unbearable at times. I could only, you know, dread to think. And you say you went on to get raped three more times after that as well. It's just, you know, unbelievable.
I didn't even realize that. It was only when I was writing my book that I thought, I just put it down to I had a lot of bad sex, really. And when I look back now, I realize I said no, they said yes, and they just carried on. I didn't understand consent, you know, I didn't. And I also thought, if I start fighting back, like the first time, it was going to get really violent. So in some ways, I just thought, ugh, well, this is all I'm good for. I'll just let them do what they want. But I know you're shocked, but really, my story isn't uncommon. You know, most men as well, you'll speak to, they've had some inappropriate behavior towards them or some sexual assault of some degree. My story is the story of many, many, many people. It's just, I'm vocal about it and I speak about it, which not many people do, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's great that you can do that. And I'm sure now it's opened the doors for a lot of victims, like I said, men and women, to help them and feel stronger to be able to speak out. How difficult was it to move on in a genuine relationship after all these terrible experiences?
Yeah, I was very, very wary of men. My main fears were really like my safety and being around men. So like, you know, as soon as I got into a car, I'd put the buttons down. If I was in a car park, I maybe wouldn't go beyond the first floor because I couldn't take a lift because a man could come in, or I'd cross the street if I saw a man. I was very suspicious, but I'm very fortunate. I do believe that life somehow intervened and I met my husband when I was only just 17. I was traveling away for a year. I was in Israel for a year. I met a Glaswegian, and somehow I just knew that I would be okay. I would be safe with him. My gut just told me I could trust him. And now it's nearly 40 years later, so obviously I was right to listen to my gut. But I didn't trust men, and I didn't know what they wanted from me. It was confusing, and it's been hard. You know, I guess in the early days in our relationship, when we were intimate, his face could turn into their face and I would fight him off me thinking it was them. Getting triggered in these moments where you think, why now, really? But it's obvious why is going to come back, because our memories are kind of stored in our mind, but they're stored in our body as well. You know, like good memories. If we smell something or hear a song, you go, oh, that was Ibiza in 1980, whatever. You know, we are triggered by memories in all sorts of ways. So I would get triggered quite a lot. But over the years now, I've worked it and worked it and worked it, and it doesn't impact on me in the way it used to.
Yeah, I just want to touch back on your friend. Has she ever reached out to apologise? Have you ever made contact with her? Or is them bridges literally just gone after, you know, she, I won't say didn't believe you, but, you know, said that it didn't happen. How was that relationship?
Yeah, it was hard. You know, I used to ask myself the questions all the time. Why would she say that? Why didn't she back me up? But I would drive myself crazy because I'd never get the answers. And obviously, social media, we could try and find her. But all of my friends that we were all at school at the same time, none of us have ever found her. So I don't know whether she's changed her name or where she is, or I've never had contact with her since I've left school. So I could only imagine where she's at with it, but there's no point doing that because I'll never know. So I just have to let that go.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a lot of guilt on one's shoulders. But you know, it's not a nice thing to have on your shoulders anyway.
Yeah, you know, I used to think when she didn't back me up, Well, maybe the same thing happened to her and she had blocked it out.
Yeah.
Maybe nothing happened to her and she didn't understand what had happened to me. Maybe she was just terrified we'd get into trouble because, you know, we'd bought alcohol, we'd met boys, we used her mum's flat. There were so many possibilities that I gave up trying to. You can't guess because it's hard enough to know what's in our own head. How can I jump into someone else's head and know what's inside there? So
yeah.
I just had to let that go.
Yeah, so also, so with your relationship, obviously you've been married for 40 years, which is amazing. In the early part of the relationship, what stage, well, did he know? Did you tell him straight away? How long did it take you to open up about your ordeals?
So he always knew. I told him that I was raped when I was 13, but, you know, he didn't really know all the details. It took me many, many years to tell him all the details. But when I first met him, when he asked me to marry him, I said, you know, I want to remind you that I made the decision I wasn't going to become a mum because in my head, I just thought giving birth, you know, you'd have your foot in stirrups and the doctors at your cervix. And it just terrified me. I just thought it was going to be like being raped again, being out of control, which was my fear. I had to try and control everything, which we can't do. But that was where I was at that time. And he was okay. But obviously, I have three gorgeous girls. So I reversed that decision, which is when I came up with my plan that I call my best revenge, because I thought if I don't become a mum, then they've won. You know, I'm handing them all of my power and control over me, and they don't even know that I'm handing it to them. But it took me till my eldest daughter was about 13, and then all my memories returned. And then I went back to therapy the last time for about 3 years. And near to the end, my therapist said, you know, maybe you should just explain to him what actually happened that night. He doesn't know all the details. And I had a real fear that if he knew what happened, he'd be put off. He wouldn't want to be with me. He wouldn't like me anymore. He wouldn't fancy me. You know, I just thought he would be disgusted. But that was, I guess, the shame really speaking loudly to me. And so the only way I could tell him all of the details of that night was in the dark, in bed one night. He was holding my hand. I said, you know, I think you should know exactly what happened. And he was great. He's very grounded and centered. And I said, you know, I thought they were going to kill me. But then he said, but they didn't. And I thought, yeah, you know, he was just very calm and just really okay. So yeah, it took a long time to tell him all of the details, but I'm pleased that I have.
Yeah, brilliant. And you talk about you've got three amazing daughters, if I'm correct.
Yes, one brilliant. Gets married very soon. So how old am I? I know.
So how difficult was it, you know, having girls, knowing what you went through and the protection that you would have obviously, you know, put over them and they not understanding, why is mum not letting me do this? Why is mum?
Yeah.
How hard was that transition?
It was hard because obviously my background, obviously I'm a mum anyway, and I'm a Jewish mother as well. Yeah. So, you know, we kind of worry maybe more than the average mother. But I suddenly saw, if I'm not careful, I could infect their minds. I could, you know, transfer all of my fears, my paranoia, my negative thoughts onto them. And I really struggled to have these girls. You know, it took me a good few years to get my head round about becoming a mum. And I thought, what's the point of bringing them into this world if I then corrupt their minds? So when Anna was about 15, I just decided I need to let them live their life, because if I wrap them up in cotton wool, they're never going to be streetwise. They're never going to learn to live. I want them to be, you know, spontaneous, independent, fierce women. But if I held them back, that's not going to happen. So at 15, she had her fake ID. She was going clubbing and people came to my house for prees. And I just made it very clear, don't ever lie to me. I don't care what you've done. If you're drinking, if you've done drugs, whatever happens, just phone one of us and we will always come and pick you up. We won't judge you. It's a normal part of growing up. And that's what we've done. And now, you know, she's 29, very sensible, has a fiance, has a dog, you know, getting married, and they don't go out and get shit-faced anymore, whatever. They've worked that through this. Well, mind you, my youngest one's still at uni, so she might. But, you know, I wanted them to live their life without me corrupting their mind. So I had to really allow them to just be, which was hard. It was really hard. It was a struggle. But, yeah, that was, to me, it made sense to let them live their life.
Yeah, I could only imagine, you know, what you went through and then having three daughters and the pressure of, you know, putting them in cotton wool must have been insane and driving you crazy in the early stages of their, you know, growing up. What part did you tell them? Do they know? Obviously, they know because they've read the books and that.
Yeah,
What
I
age?
always. Well, you think they've read the book, but maybe not. But I always told them like at age appropriate age. So when they were little, they just knew that two boys hurt mummy very badly. So, and then as it got older and I speak to them about consent or domestic abuse or healthy relationships, then they understood what rape was. And when I was writing the book, I said, you know, here's a copy for all of you. And I think Anna read the chapter about her. Mimi read the very end, which is what she does. And Layla, who wasn't even yet 13, she read the whole thing. So they're all very different. But they've come to some of my speaking events and they've heard me speak as well. So they, you know, they know what I do and they're fine with that. But it's I think we can't hide what happens, as even though it's awful, we need to be honest, you know, because you can't sugarcoat these things. This is part of life. It's the paradox. There's always something like that's happening, and there's always beautiful stuff going on as well. You know, it's everything. Life makes up both sides of it.
Yeah. So did you see a change when they found out about, you know, what happened to mom, and was they more cautious, more aware of these troubles once hearing from you? Or
I don't think so, because they see me now and they see me how I am, and that's why I said, you know, don't think back to that 13-year-old girl, look at me now. And they, you know, my oldest one, she says, you've just shown us that we can get through anything, and you've shown us that we are stronger than we think we are. And that's the message that I want them to see, that I did have this awful experience, and I went through many years of, you know, trauma and recovery, but they know that you can recover. And that's what I want to show them as well, that we can go through tough times, but it's okay. You can get through them as well.
Yeah. Well, you've not only shown them, you've shown me you can get through anything. you talk about moving out, you best dealt with moving on from what happened was forgiveness. And listening to you, I was in awe, because I think I've still not forgiven people for a lot less. And maybe I should, and maybe I will be at peace and maybe able to move on and not have such stigma about a certain situation. But how did you do that to forgive such a terrible thing?
Well, first of all, it's a very personal journey, and I don't tell, I'm not like a forgiveness preacher. I don't tell people that you have to forgive. You know, there's many, many ways that lead to the same path, but it was, again, when I was going for therapy and Anna was 13 and all the memories came back. And very near to the end of these 3 years, my therapist, you know, just sent this suggestion to my mind that maybe they weren't born rapists. And I was just like, what a stupid thing to say, you know. I don't care about them, you know. I was just so angry and bitter and full of resentment and sarcastic all the time. But he kind of got me thinking, and I just thought, I wonder why or how they could be so violent towards someone else. And I really worked out in my mind that when they were dehumanizing me, they're really just dehumanizing themselves. You know, they weren't connected to their self, their goodness, their fire, whatever I think we're all born with. And somehow I just kind of felt sorry for them, because I thought, you know, I've done a really good job of cleaning up the trauma, decades of different types of therapy. I thought they've got to live with what they've done to someone else. And I don't think that was easy. And then I just thought I could take it one step further. You know, I could choose to forgive them just to make total peace, because before I forgave them, I was tied to the past. I was tied to them like chains that linked me to them. You know, but it wasn't like I needed a meeting. I didn't need to sit down and have a chat with them. It was a decision I could make really in my heart, just to kind of let it go. So forgiveness to me is about understanding. It's about coming to terms. It's about accepting. It's about knowing the past, but you can't change it anyway. And it really was allowing me to let it go. So I guess it was my key to freedom. So it was never for them. It was always for me, because I deserve to move on with it.
Yeah, I just want to talk about, you know, rape. The stigma around it, people think it's brutal, you know, you were chained or held down, but it can be so, you know, men need to know, because my probably listeners are predominantly men, that it can be so subtle as they just say no once.
Yeah.
You know, maybe not serious, but being scared to like really be forceful, say no, 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 or just saying no once and you thinking it's a joke and continuing, that could be deemed as rape to the girl just because she's like, again, not being screaming no, shouting no.
I think you need to be very clear. You need to have an enthusiastic yes, and you need to really maybe just, I mean, check as you go along. Are you okay with this? Is this what you want? But an enthusiastic yes is really what you need to get, and it should be quite obvious.
Yeah, 100%. And I hope people who are listening, who, like I said, who've gone through any man, women, gone through what you've been through, or, you know, anything of the sort, you know, they should really, don't be ashamed, don't be embarrassed. It's not you, you know, something bad's happened to you. So you should speak out to family members or whoever's there to listen. I think it would help massively. And that goes for any, you know, mental health illness issues. You know, once you speak out about them, it does lift a little weight off your shoulders and hopefully put you in the right direction.
Yeah, it's very hard to find your voice. So, you know, it's like a process to build up to speaking. I remember just always walking into my mum's bedroom when she was bedridden, just standing by her bed and just couldn't say anything. She said, "Is something you want to say?" No, and I just couldn't get the words out. But now I think it's very different, especially with the hashtag Me Too. It was like a catalyst. It was like a domino effect where one person speaks out, it helps other people find a voice. And that's really what I kind of want to do, to show people that you've got nothing to be ashamed about. You know, 100% of all rapes are caused by rapists. It wasn't anything to do with my clothes or the alcohol or how I behaved, whatever. It just came down to those two men who chose to rape me. And it took me a long time to see that I shouldn't be ashamed of a crime that was committed against my body. I'm not what they did to me. I held on to inappropriate shame for years. And I think so many people do that. And we listen to the shame as well. You know, we listen to it when it tells us, well, people won't believe us, or the shame tells you that, oh, don't tell anyone, it's not safe. But it's never too late to find your voice. And finding your voice is definitely the first step in getting support and getting help, because you can always heal. There's always support there.
Yeah, obviously you've got to have a great structure and back, help as well, because like I said, it is a difficult to speak about that, to admit it, what you've gone through. There is a big stigma about it. But I also want to talk about not the victims, but the people who commit the crime. We are not, you know, we're not brought into this world evil. Yeah. You know, we're not brought into to murderers, to rapists, to you know, any crime that they commit. So they must have been so troubled within their life, something deep happened to them that they feel that they need to, you know, conflict such a crime upon others. And it's shame. And it's a massive shame.
I think it's the way we deal with trauma. You know, there's so much work needs to do with trauma and to help people heal. So one of the things that really helped me was my manager when I worked as a psychotherapist in a counselling centre in Glasgow. She used to be a midwife, and she told me out of all the thousands of babies she delivered, she hadn't met an evil one. And that, you know, it just always stayed with me. You know, when we hold a little baby and you look at them, there's nothing evil in a baby. There may be some psychopaths and some narcissistic that perhaps could be born that way. But I think the majority of people just get corrupted. They get conditioned, whether it's by experience or by watching or by hearing, or overexposure to violence or whatever their upbringing. And it's an interesting topic because not everybody that's exposed to that will go on to commit crimes against people, but some people will. And it was really that made me try to understand, you know, they must have been through something. And that's when I kind of felt sympathy towards them. It's not to excuse what happened.
Yeah, but I was about to say, it's not to excuse it or advocate it, or, you know, oh, it's okay, he had a bad upbringing. No, not at all, far from it. I think it's absolutely disgusting, but, you know, it can be maybe getting helped from at such an early stage in one's life to keep them off that path. Like I had a bad upbringing and I had childhood trauma, which, you know, results into mistakes, you know, for my career, really, more than anything. It was like a self-destruct button, which, you know, if I had a better guidance when I was younger, I wouldn't have been in that position. But I'm here doing a podcast to speak about it, to help younger the generation who may be in the same situation to understand.
I think we don't realize when we're the ones that are sabotaging. You know, we don't see that it's self-sabotaging, because we get so caught by whatever's happened. We blame everything externally, but it's always internally. It's always an inside job to improve ourselves, to grow personally and to expand ourselves. It's never really something that's happening out there. It's because it's how we respond to whatever's gone on, really, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And like I said, listening to your story, it's put a little fire in my belly to go out there and know that, you know, no matter what's happened in my life and career, I can now, you know, resurrect, get better, do better. And, you know, if it's helping others, and I'm all for it. I'm looking forward to it. So like I said, your story is amazing, and whoever hasn't listened, you know, should, you know, go on to your TED talk, listen to your book. It's on Audible as well.
It is,
so yes. Yeah, so please go out there, listen to it, and the way it's helped me, it will definitely help others.
Great, thank you so much.
No, absolute pleasure. So Madeline, thank you for your time. Could be here all day with talking to you. It's been absolutely amazing. And What's next in store for yourself?
I never really plan anything. I just wait till it all comes to me. So I've got a few more in-person talking events going on, which is good, because lots of stuff obviously has been online. My podcast, which I started in lockdown, is still happening. It's called Unbroken Healing Through Storytelling. And again, I speak to people that have overcome adversity, but they haven't just bounced back, they've bounced forward, and they're making a difference in life to other people. So I just have met the most incredible people. So like you, I love meeting people and hearing how they got how they overcame stuff and how they got past, so it's helpful for others as well.
Yeah, brilliant. And if anyone wants to contact you, Madeline Black Instagram, amazing. So again, Madeline, thank you so much for taking time out and telling us your remarkable story and how you've come through that dark part and being a wonderful advocate, speaker as well. It's been an absolute pleasure.
You're welcome. Thank you.
thank you. That was amazing.
You're welcome. So you're on the cheap Zoom, aren't you? Because it's got time left. He's panicking there, like, oh, I've only got 5 minutes. So I don't know much about your story. So maybe I know that you are an ex-footballer, because I live with a household of Gooners, and I know you were in the under 21s. I said, Stephen, do you know, he was a Gooner. So yeah, so yeah, I know that. Yeah. But so if ever you want to be a guest, I know now you'll be busy, but I'd be very happy to interview you as well.
100%. No, any time. Just drop us a message or email with Jess, and we'll pick in. Yeah, Maya was a tough chat.
It's good to collaborate, because if I mention your show, then you know.
Yeah,
just don't know
exactly. So Maya was just basically, you know, I never had a mother around. Okay. She left when I was three, and then my dad kind of brought me up. It was moving from woman to woman, stepmom, and drugs was a lot of drugs and crime.
It'd be interesting your outlook on women then, if you're always
It's correct. It was my outlook was, I always went from woman to woman. Okay. You know, I needed that. I craved the attention that I never got from, you know, my mother figure, because she's never there. So I craved the attention, and I was, you know, I always had multiple relationships. So I wasn't faithful, because when things went bad, I would seek validation from another woman.
New model. Okay.
So story is interesting. It's dark as well. So I'll be more than happy to come on.
Good. Great. Right. Lovely to meet you. Have a
you
good
too.
Day.
You too. Take care.
See you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Brutally Honest, and I want to say a massive thank you to Madeline Black for sharing her amazing story. And don't forget to subscribe. You can find it on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast from, for weekly episodes. So for now, take care.